This episode is brought to you by Seems Easy Record Sleeve Repair Strips. If you collect used records, you need some Seems Easy strips handy for record sleeve repair. They're super easy to use and repair those seam splits to make them like new.
Ask your record store for Seems Easy or go to SeemsEasy.com.
Seems Easy with two Z's. SeemsEasy.com. And now, on with the show. Hey everyone, it's Nate. Welcome to episode 366 of The Vinyl Guide, the podcast for record collectors and music nerds. And this week we've got an amazing guest here to talk vinyl, music, and more, Mr. Gerald V. Casale, or Jerry, as we're now on less formal terms. Jerry's on the show, and you'll likely know Jerry as a co-founder and songwriter of Devo. Perhaps you know him from the Jihad Jerry and the Evildoers Project. You may even have heard his new single, The Invisible Man, or better yet, seen the video. If you haven't, go to GeraldVCasale.com. The video is right there. It's pretty wacky, but that's what we've come to expect from Jerry, and we discuss all of that today. Plus, we get some great stories about the early days of Devo, the private releases on Boogie Boy Records, the events that led up to that historic Saturday Night Live appearance, playing Satisfaction for Mick Jagger, the current state of Devo, the challenges with calling his band Jihad Jerry and the Evildoers directly after the invasion of Iraq, and other great stories and insights from a guy who's been making some pretty brave artistic choices for nearly five decades. And there's something I gotta tell you. This Record Store Day Black Friday, Gerald has a new single, The Invisible Man. It's a 12-inch, 45 RPM, clear vinyl. It's Gerald's recent collaboration with Steve Bartak of Oingo Boingo and Josh Fries from just about every band you love. And you can see the Invisible Man video now. There's several remixes on the vinyl. It's a nice collectible or gift this holiday season. Grab a copy of The Invisible Man at your local record shop. Again, there's 12-inch clear vinyl. It's even on cassette and CD. And it's all available in limited quantities this Record Store Day, Black Friday. Finally, if you're new to the Vinyl Guide podcast, welcome, welcome, welcome. We've got hundreds of episodes and interviews to enjoy, including episode 355 with East Bay Ray of Dead Kennedys, episode 257 with Amon Tobin, episode 299 with Kenny Jones of The Who and The Faces, episode 331 with John Dwyer of OCs and Castleface Records, Tommy Chong of Cheech and Chong joined us episode 320, Fred Armisen of Saturday Night Live in Portlandia stopped by to talk punk rock and box sets episode 289, the legend himself Gary Newman episode 284, even Wolfgang Fleur of Kraftwerk episode 140, and heaps of others, all available anytime to enjoy. Simply subscribe or follow the Vinyl Guide podcast for free in your podcast app. Scroll, download, listen, and enjoy. Alrighty, my chit-chat is over. Let's get into our conversation with Mr. Gerald V. Casale. Alright, ladies and gentlemen, this week on The Vinyl Guide, we have Gerald V. Casale, who you may know from Devo, Jihad Jerry and the Evildoers, and there's some other solo stuff which we'll get into today. Gerald, whatever.
Yes.
Thank you so much for joining us today. Much appreciated, mate.
I'm glad to be here.
Now, I started researching this interview with a lot of questions about Devo and the earlier part of your career. And the more and the more, and we'll get to some of that, but the more and more I dug, the more I became absolutely fascinated with kind of these last several years. And especially with this new release, The Invisible Man, you've got a Record Store Day single out and a few other things coming out. So this is a bit like, a revisitation of some of the material of your career.
Yes, some of that is true. In addition to the new stuff that I collaborate with Josh Fries and Steve Bartek from Oingo Boingo on, which I'm excited about because it's more in the spirit of the original Devo collaboration that was exciting to begin with, where we were experimental, where we didn't start with premises that we had to fulfill. You know, we weren't defining things up front. We were thinking multimedia-wise. So it's exciting from a creative angle.
Mm. Well, what does that sort of collaboration look like early on? Like, I guess you had it earlier in your career with Devo. You're feeling it again now. What is it that kind of makes that creative process special?
People that are still engaged with getting off on ideas, you know, and you like them and they like you, so there's chemistry. And when you're together, it feels effortless. It's not working. It's you're playing. It's childish, right? You're laughing. Mm-hmm. And then somebody goes, look at this. How about this sound? And you go, that's hilarious. Do that twice as often, you know, and you start going somewhere.
Okay. So people perhaps staying a little bit more in touch with their playful or exploratory selves.
Yeah.
Perhaps not growing up so quickly.
Yeah. And I mean, certainly everyone that I'm involved with already succeeded, you know, in their professional path, and they have no illusions about what we're trying to do here. You know, we know we're not going to be, put on the radio like Dua Lipa, you know, or Lizzo or Megan Thee Stallion, or force-fed to people 24/7 like, you know, Taylor Swift. We're senior citizens, and we're showing that we're still alive and still the creative people that we were.
Mm. Okay, you're making art for art's sake. You're still having fun with it.
True.
There's no pressure for you to try to get something in the top 10 because that's not the point.
It's not going to happen.
Yeah,
it's not going to happen. I mean, the gatekeepers aren't going to let that happen. They wouldn't even give you the time of day, no matter how good the song was. They wouldn't listen to it. So, you know, and I understand all that up front. I know the culture we live in, and I know the times we live in, and I know they're more devolved than even we could have anticipated.
That's right. I heard this phrase, everything the dead Kennedy said is true, and I'm starting to realize that about Devo as well.
Absolutely.
So, look, I want to talk more about this.
Yeah.
There's a moment in my life that, as a music lover, sticks with me. And I've heard the story of people, you know, a generation older than me that were inspired when they saw the Beatles on Ed Sullivan. That was the big, you know, kablooey moment that changed everything for them. I have a similar one, but to me, it was when Devo was on Saturday Night Live. To me, in my musical taste, there's before that period, there's BC or BD, before Devo and after Devo. That really just knocked me out. And I've talked to other people about that, and they've had a very similar experience. I suppose you've heard stories like that and realized the levity of that moment in your career. Yeah.
Yeah. That's oft repeated, you know, when we would meet people and do news conferences and do question and answer sessions with the backstage, you know, where the fans come back. Oftentimes somebody will say, and it's understandable, because now when I watch it, you know, when I see an old clip of us from that night, I think it was October 18th, 1978, it's outrageous. It's kind of, it doesn't seem plausible what you're looking at. And of course we were so pumped up and so nervous that we played faster and tighter than ever. And it doesn't look real. People said, oh, you manipulated the video that night, didn't you? And it's like, no, Lorne Michaels would never do that. You know, it had to be real. And it was all live. I mean, the voiceover announcer, whoever that was it Don Pardo?
Don Pardo, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, you're all set up. You rehearse all week with the cast. You get your slot and you run through the show as if it's live, like starting on Thursday. And so by the time you're there for real Saturday night, you've been integrated. You know, you've been inculcated. And yet now it's real. And the audience is right in your face. It's like bleachers that are literally 10 feet from you. And they're staring at you. The lights go off, and Lorne Michaels comes over with an assistant with a flashlight pointing it at his face from below him, like Goulardi, you know, like a Halloween. And he goes, all right, you guys, now don't make a sound, don't move. when you hear Don Pardo's voice announce you and he says the name Devo, you start playing your asses off. I don't care if the lights don't come on. I don't care if your amplifier doesn't work. I don't give a hell what's going on. You're live and you're in front of 15 million people and don't blow it. And then the light goes off on his face and you're standing there and about 20 seconds later, you hear him, "Now, ladies and gentlemen, welcome, recording artist Devo." And you're just, you know, if you could shit your pants, you would. And people didn't believe what they were seeing or hearing. They didn't. The audience at home said, "What the hell is this?"
Yeah. Speaking for myself, I was probably 9 at the time or something like that. And seeing that, I mean, it was like, there were kids in my class that were into Kiss for obvious reasons because they were such like comic book. But I mean, to me, when I saw Devo, I was like, fuck, are these guys like robots? This is before I saw Kraftwerk or anyone like that. So the first time I had an opportunity to see, look how they're moving back and forth and all the shit that's on their guitar. That is wild. To me, that was, you know, I wanted Devo action figures at that point. Did Lauren, did all those people, did they actually kind of get Devo at the time? Was it weird? Was it welcoming?
Certainly Lauren didn't get it. The only reason we were on that show is that this is something that was a goal of Devo since 1975, is to be on Saturday Night Live from the first time we saw the show. And of course, we were getting nowhere reaching that goal. But when we, through Neil Young, we agreed to have Elliot Roberts, who was his manager, be our manager. And when Elliot said, "What do you want, Devo? What would make you feel great about me being your manager?" And I go, "Get us on Saturday Night Live, ha ha." And he goes, "Big deal. Lauren's a friend of mine. I'll get you on Saturday Night Live." And of course, what he did is he promised Lorne Neil Young, because Lorne had been after Neil for 3 years, ever since the show started. So he promised him if he took this band, Devo, that he now represented, he'd give him Neil. So Lorne bit. Lorne didn't give a shit. Lorne just thought, "Devo, what the fuck is this?" But the cast, you know, John Belushi decided we were cool. And Lorraine Newman decided we were cool. So that was a plus. And then, of course, after we played, we had to stop the planned tour that we were starting right after that show, right? None of the, you know, they were little venues, right? Clubs, 200-seaters. Biggest was like 400 seats. We had to stop it and recalibrate the whole tour, call new venues and start over, because it just went from nobody knowing who in the hell Devo was to that night on Saturday Night Live. And we started playing, you know, the Santa Monica Civics of the world, 2,000, 3,000, you know, the Fox in Atlanta. I mean, and it just mushroomed.
What was it? Was it hard being Devo beforehand in the early days? I mean, coming out of Ohio, trying to get gigs and playing, I think, Max's Kansas City. Like, how difficult was it being Devo back then?
Well, it was a farce. I mean, you know, I was, you know, I believed and lived and breathed the gestalt of Devo in the pose and the philosophy. And I kind of masochistically got a lot of pleasure being treated like a nutball and a loser, because I didn't think so. You know, I thought, we're going to prevail. Fuck these people. If you don't like us, fuck you. You know, the whole thing. Mm-hmm. Strident. And so it was a farce trying to get gigs. Nobody even believed we were real. They felt sorry for us. You know, or they threw beer cans at us and beer bottles at us. And that all happened.
Like, you show up at these places and, you know, everyone's kind of having a beer, almost a honky-tonk, like a scene out of the Blues Brothers. And here you guys come with your yellow jumpsuits. Very striking contrast.
And that's actually what happened. We'd play this bar with a stage, and we'd get threatened. And one of our biggest triumphs was this bar in Akron, where the owner, who was also tending bar, paid us $50 not to play the second set.
Wow.
So we left and we went to a restaurant down the street and treated ourselves to a little dinner with burgers and beer and thought we'd really gotten over on them.
Getting paid not to play. If you could keep that up, you got it made.
Yeah.
So having those themes, like the suits, like, you know, I'm picturing in my mind, you know, each Devo album has like a different theme. And even up to now, to present, it seems like there's an aesthetic to each item you work with. Jihad Jerry, same sort of thing. I get the feeling there's some visual elements in The Invisible Man that are married together, and I'm not sure how. That was really quite important from day one, wasn't it?
Well, to me, obviously they are.
Yeah.
I mean, from the beginning, you know, Devo was a meta response to the world. It was a construct that where the whole was bigger than the sum of the parts, you know, where you're taking one kind of thing and another kind of thing, creating an environment for it, an alternate world, an armor, more or less, both philosophical and visual. Because Mark and I were visual artists. That's how we met. I was a student and I was majoring in studio art. And I met him because he was coming and cherry picking some art classes at Kent State University. And I ran into him. And we shared an aesthetic. And so you build this whole world. And so your presentation visually is important to us, at least, as the music. In fact, it was hand in hand. It's like when you see Devo and hear Devo, doesn't it seem to you that that's what you'd have to see if that's what you were hearing?
Oh, yeah. Look, there has to be there's a marriage, and there's like this theme. It seems to me there's different periods that lend themselves to different visual themes. And once, like you say, you get it locked in your head, of course, there's no other alternative at that point. But that was a very extraordinarily new concept in the 70s, wasn't it? I mean, now we get what's called branding. We get kind of the stylists and that sort of thing. But that really didn't exist or very prominently back then.
And those labels and terms, that terminology didn't exist. Nobody talked about branding, at least not in the world of music and art. And no one talked about performance art, you know. And what was Devo doing? That was performance art. We were using music, but then how we would present ourselves on stage and how we would, you know, engage the audience almost in a polarizing and political manner was intentional. It was premeditated, talked about, thought out, and then we'd try it. You know, and then we'd find out how to change that given the realities empirically of what happened to us, and we got better at it.
That's true, because I guess when you see Devo, especially in the early days, if you're not familiar with them, you kind of have to pick a side. This is cool, or what the fuck? Or it could be actually that actually could lend itself to both. But yeah, you had to pick a side of whether you were interested or absolutely not.
And we were asking them to pick a side. We were. Mm-hmm. It's either like, you get this or you think we're stupid nerds, you know, that's fine with us. Which is it, you know?
These were kind of alter egos, though, and you guys seem to have gotten it right early on. So I would imagine there was some experimentation prior to that of just kind of learning how to be. Okay, can you just kind of walk through that at a bit of a high level?
Yeah, it's a lot that the world didn't see because, you know, we weren't in a big city like New York where you play some little club and you're still forming and experimenting. And then once you play that little club, it could be over because everybody in the world, the next day, you know, you've been judged, right? Well, we labored in obscurity. Nobody gave a shit. And so in 1975, you know, we played live gigs. In 1976, we played live gigs in Akron, in Cuyahoga Falls, in Kent, you know, in Cleveland. And we didn't have yellow suits, and we weren't moving the way we moved. And there was lingering between songs, and Bob Mothersbaugh was swigging from a bottle of beer in between songs, like Keith Richards or something. You know, it was, and we were all individuals. Like, he was Clown, Bob Mothersbaugh. Mark only appeared as Boogie Boy. I was Lieutenant Casanova, you know. The drummer was Jungle Jim. So we had these, like, it was more like Captain Beefheart with these kind of like ridiculous names, you know, that people are individually alter egos, but they're not, there's not a meta group identity. It's not the Five Musketeers.
But even in that point, each of you had different dress, different style?
Yeah.
Okay. So Lieutenant Casanova, how does Lieutenant Casanova
dress? Well, I had a white lab coat that I got from, you know, industrial supply store. And I took tampons and dipped them in three primary latex colors, yellow, red, and blue. And then I sewed onto the coat bands of multicolored tampons so that it looked like some kind of Native American garb. Because every time I'd move, every time I'd spin, you know, they're flying around.
It's like the fringe, like the Aussie tassels or whatever.
Pretty much, yeah. The coat of many colors, yeah. And then on my head, I had something that was bizarre. It was a custom fabricated leather headband that came down into a cowl with a ridiculous kind of leftover from the hippie days, a piece of cheap jewelry that was stylized sun with rays.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it was, you know, I had more in common with Captain Beefheart's band than anything, I think.
So moving from where the band is doing these five different alter egos to then bringing them together, yeah, in a kind of a cohesive view, do you recall the conversation or what led to that evolution or de-evolution?
Yeah, I mean, exactly. There were lots of conversations, but I think practically what happened is when you start to play live and you realize how you're trashing whatever you're wearing by that night by playing in it and sweating 3 or 4 pounds off in it, and the cost of then getting other clothes or dry cleaning the clothes you had on or whatever, I started to think, you know, what about disposable? Like, what about something disposable? And then I worked for a janitorial supply firm doing their catalogs and their graphics. And I saw the yellow suits advertised.
Right.
And at that time, they were $2.65 a suit. So I ordered one to look at it and figured out that if I could find any kind of a waistband or a cinch belt, I could make it look like something if it was tucked in rather than just some drapey balloon, you know. And so I went to a Salvation Army, found a woman's cinch belt from the 50s that was, you know, about 3 inches wide. Suddenly you had a waistline back when we were all nice and skinny, and you had this puffy, you know, plastic coated yellow fabric suit, Tyvek material, synthetic. And we stenciled Devo on the chest and took a look at ourselves in them and said, that's it. Hey, that is chic.
And all the moves, the jerkiness, all that stuff, it just kind of, I imagine that uniform brought out something in other members of the band that, you know,
correct,
lent themselves to that aesthetic.
Yeah.
Now, this podcast is, we talk a lot about records and collectibles and things like
yes,
that. And
yeah, vinyl.
Yeah, absolutely. And early in Devo's career, there was Boogie Boy Records.
Right.
On Boogie Boy Records, there were a few singles. you guys started recording, I think, Jocko Homo, and you had a single for Satisfaction. Tell me the story of those records, because I think those were self-funded, self-created by the band, yeah?
So, yes, we love vinyl. We grew up with vinyl. You know, we are from that era. We miss vinyl, but vinyl's back. I mean, it was, you know, vinyl was almost like an art object. It was something to be revered, to be, you know, preserved, and you took it seriously, and you tried not to scratch it. And it was, you know, almost like a precious object, right? Especially the 12-inch vinyls, because of the size of the graphics and the liner notes and everything in it. It was, you know, you experienced that whole album, and the sequencing of the songs was determined by the artist. You weren't putting anything on shuffle. You put the record on and sat down, or probably smoked pot and laid down, and went on this trip with the vinyl, and you listened to every cut. That's an arcane idea these days, right? Nobody would even bother.
Well, I mean, even with the format, it just seems so alien, like this black orb that, you know, it doesn't require any chips or tubes or anything, and it spins, which in itself is, you know, very hypnotic. And the audio that comes out of it can be tuned to such a level that it reverberates your whole body. It sounds wonderful. Yeah.
I mean, you certainly remember the almost like, what would be the word, like cult-like and obsessive culture surrounding sound systems, like which speakers you had, what preamps you had, you know. And of course, year after year, there'd be somebody that would take over the last thing, like, oh, you don't want that anymore. You got to have this Pioneer, blah, blah. And of course, the fidelity was amazing.
Oh, yeah. So Devo created these records early in the career on Boogie Boy Records. And I think, were these all self-funded? What do you recall about the creation of?
They were. Like the very first one, Mark and I actually drove personally to Queen City Records. I think it was Cincinnati is where that was. And the reason we picked that place is they had a claim to fame that they had pressed James Brown singles. And so we went, wow, you know, because we were huge James Brown fans. So if it's good enough for James Brown, that's where Devo's going to go. And that's where we took Jocko Homo and Mongoloid, the A and the B side of the first Boogie Boy record, do-it-yourself single. And we had worked with a local graphics house in printing house, rather, in Akron. Mark and I did all the layout graphics and brought them the cover, and they printed the covers. And the covers, there was a novel idea that we had to manually assemble ourselves. So after we went to Queen City Records and got this first pressing of 1,000 Devo records, we drove them back, and in our apartments in Akron, we sat there and assembled one at a time these covers that were it was a threefold, not just a gatefold, it was a threefold. And with graphics on the inside and the lyrics to both songs printed on the inside, because they were printed on both sides.
Right.
It was a big deal, you know. And it was all sealed then with a little adhesive color disc, like the little 1-inch sealer.
And what was the plan for that record? I mean, you got 1,000. That's a lot of records.
The plan.
What were you thinking would happen with those records? Sell them at gigs? How would you move them out into the world?
Yeah, there were independent record stores in Akron and Cleveland. And the most famous one was in Cleveland. And now I can't remember the guy's name. He was so famous. Everybody went there. That was like everybody that ever wanted to put out their own record, you know, stood in line waiting for this guy to say yay or nay. And he decided he'd put it in a bin space for us, you know. And it's the same record store that would sell the Cleveland band that was so famous with Crocus Behemoth as these head vocalist and synth player. They're huge in the area. Anyway, we were all stoked because we got into this store next to them. Mm-hmm. And it went from there because there's a network. We didn't even really know about the network. Because of this guy, then several other stores, we'll take 20, you know, we'll take 15.
Oh, okay.
And it got to Stiff Records in England. And that's when all hell broke loose. They wanted 500.
Wow. Okay.
So Stiff Records. So people erroneously thought Devo was an English band because the biggest exposure we got was out of England. And people assumed because it was coming out of there and Stiff Records that we were English.
So you sent the tapes to Stiff or did you send records to Stiff?
No.
How did you?
Okay. No, we didn't even send them. That's what I'm saying. There's a network going on there and Stiff Records got wind of the guy in Cleveland selling these singles, you know, and got themselves one and decided this is it. We want this.
Right.
And, you know, they did really well with us. And then we told them, hey, we got a song called Be Stiff. And they went, what? You got a song called Be Stiff? We got to hear it. You know? And so then they wanted to.
They were all in.
Exclusively. Oh, yeah.
There was a release early in Devo, Mechanical Man, on Elevator Records.
Yes. Yes.
There's a conjecture whether it's a bootleg or whether the band had anything to do with it.
No, it is a bootleg. For real.
It is a bootleg. Okay. All right. Do you know much of the history behind it? Who was the bootlegger or how it came to be?
We tried to track it down. We think the guy was an Englishman.
Oh, that narrows it down.
I know.
Those bloody Englishmen. I also heard a rumor that on the Are We Not Men album, obviously Bowie was supposed to produce it. Brian Eno ended up producing it, but I heard but Robert Fripp was interested in getting involved. Is that true?
We'll be back after these messages.
Hey everyone, I'm here to talk to you about Seems Easy record sleeve repair strips. Ever find a record in a used bin where the vinyl is gorgeous, but the sleeve has this ugly split and is even falling completely apart? Well, that's okay. Grab it anyway, because with Seems Easy record sleeve repair strips, you can fix that right up.
Seems Easy record repair strips repair seam splits from the inside,
so it doesn't affect the appearance of a record sleeve, but it does make it functional again. With Seems Easy, records can now slide in and out like new.
Turn a $5 record into a $25 functioning collectible.
Just ask your local record shop for Seems Easy strips, and if they're not in stock, go to seamseasy.com. That's Seems Easy with two Z's. Seems Easy record sleeve repair strips. Seems easy because it is. Oh, and hey, record nerds, don't forget to clean your records with the very best and safest record cleaner, the Groove Washer. Make your records look and sound their very best and store them with confidence using the new Groove Washer Groove Guard record sleeves. You gotta try this out. It makes a huge difference to the quality of your vinyl experience. Ask for the Groove Washer by name at your local record store and accept no substitutes. Or head over to groovewasher.com and use discount code VINYLGUIDE10.
All hail the Groove Washer.
That's groovewasher.com, discount code VINYLGUIDE10.
Now we return to the program, already in progress.
No limits. I also heard a rumor that on the Are We Not Men album, obviously Bowie was supposed to produce it. Brian Eno ended up producing it. But I heard Robert Fripp was interested in getting involved. Is that true?
Yeah, you know, the details of that are hazy now. I'm trying to remember how, but I mean, of course, he was in that universe with those people. Yeah. You know, they were all sharing and conversing with each other. I mean, Bowie listened to our first single because Iggy Pop gave it to him. You know, that is a small world. But yes, Fripp heard... I think he saw the first 10-minute film, The Truth About De-Evolution, and he heard the self-produced single with Jaco Homo and Mongoloid. And yes, he wanted to have something to do with it, but it just wasn't working out, you know, in terms of how that would logistically happen.
Okay. Was the album Are We Not Men, was it always going to be called Are We Not Men, or were there any other titles bandied about?
No, that was always it. That was really, we had worked that out like 3 years prior. This is what we were going to, never wavered from that.
Okay. And from hearing the early demos and, of course, the early videos and seeing the earlier versions of those songs, it seems like the template for recording the album was pretty well set. When the band stepped away from that recording session, were they happy with the record? Did they feel it represented them? Did they feel manipulated at all from the production?
No, we did feel like that something independent got going because of Conor Plank's mixing techniques and some of the outboard equipment he was using and the nature of the board in the room. And of course that happens to everybody, every band. And especially in the beginning, when you're not as conversant with those strange kind of mutations that take place, you can't roll with the punches. So we didn't even know exactly what we had until it was too late to do anything about it. You know, it's like, okay, that's what happened. This is how it sounds once it's mastered on vinyl and fit, you know. Mm-hmm. And it was just one version of Devo, one version. I always liked us better live, personally. I like what we sound like live.
Oh, well, I mean, just tell people can dial up a myriad of different live shows of Devo, especially ones back in the day. If you could find even Saturday Night Live, that is, you know,
that's a good one.
It's a couple BPM faster and it gets everyone going. And I would agree. Now, creating Satisfaction, such a, you know, pulling any element out of the original Rolling Stones song and just completely reconstructing it, I absolutely adore. What was the conversation around the idea to approach the cover that way?
That's one where, rather than all the kind of premeditated, pretentious concept intellectualization that went on with Devo, we're together, we're working on songs we've already, you know, developed pretty far along, but always again there was this experimentation and spontaneity. And my brother Bob Casale, who was Bob number two in the band, started playing on the guitar, and he just kept doing it, and strange fingering on three strings, playing two at once sometimes to get that, but it's not a full chord. And, you know, we're kind of just mildly amused. And then Alan Myers, who was just an incredible drummer, started putting down that beat where the snare was on the one rather than typical rock, like kick, one, two, three, four. Right. Snare is on the one. Then he's hitting a cowbell. And, of course, now you just got pure wacky art music, and I'm going, oh my god, that sounds like backwards reggae, ha ha ha, you know. And I pick up my bass and I go, keep doing it, and I think I'm going to come up with what a reggae bass player would play to what he was hearing if, like, you thought about reggae backwards. So that's when I started going do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do- Mark grabs the microphone and starts singing Paint It Black over the top. Just start. And it's kind of weird. It's not really gelling. And my brother stops, you know, and this has been going on 20 minutes now. And my brother stops and he goes, "No, Mark, sing Satisfaction. Sing Satisfaction." Mark starts singing Satisfaction and everybody's smiling and laughing and like, "Oh, this is, that's hilarious." And then we stop and put the change in. So, you know, and I try. So now we put a change in the song. Now for the next 3 hours, you can imagine what Devo did over and over and over until it's sounding great. And Mark starts going ding, 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 over the top, ding, 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 you know, almost just like a metronome. Mm-hmm. And Bob Mothersbaugh started playing a fifth of that on his guitar. That became the last two parts that come into the song, and they are the last two parts in our particular recording that are added arrangement-wise. They come in as the song. Mm-hmm. What devolves, maybe, you know, and there it was. You're right, it was a perfect, and again, another word that was not used at the time. Devo had just deconstructed probably one of the greatest rock and roll songs ever written, and a huge hit. So we were not making fun of the Rolling Stones, as Rolling Stone magazine liked to report, because Jan Wenner hated us. We loved Satisfaction. We loved a lot of the Rolling Stones songs. You know, like any kid that grew up in that period, they were the shit.
Right.
You know, the Rolling Stones. Songs like Sympathy for the Devil and Street Fighting Man, I mean, come on. Mm-hmm. You know, not to mention, you know, Jumpin' Jack Flash and 19th Nervous Breakdown and, you know, on and on. So we just practiced it. We got really good. And, of course, we couldn't wait for an opportunity to finally record this. We knew we had to put out a single. And that's the way it went. And it came from a jam. It came from a spontaneous jam.
Wow. Because that's, to me, that's, you know, with maybe All Along the Watchtower or Johnny Cash's Hurt. You know, that's one of my...
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah. I mean, someone, an artist who's taken a piece of work that stands on its own right, clearly, and then taken it completely somewhere different and deeper.
Yeah.
Did you ever hear any feedback from any of the Rolling Stones about your song, especially in the early days?
Yeah.
What was their reaction?
Well, we had to.
Okay.
Again, you got to think about this. This is 1978. People took intellectual property and authorship seriously. There was not even any sampling going on then.
Yeah.
So our record company said, you can't put this song on the record. You're going to have to get permission, because what you've done here is considered parody. And parody will get us sued. So we had to meet Mick Jagger. Mark and I had to meet Mick Jagger in New York City with his guy, Peter Rudge, at the time, near the Warwick Hotel, in some sumptuous office of Rudge's, fireplace going, leather club chairs, you know,
old school
walnut desk.
Yeah.
Yeah, walnut desk. You know, a wine cabinet behind him that he produced a bottle of claret and gave it to Mick. And we had to play it for Mick. And if Mick was offended or didn't like it, it was over. So, you know, we came with a little cassette and a boombox. And we put the boombox on the mantle of the fireplace. Jagger sat in one of the big oversized club chairs, looking very sleepy at 2 p.m. He had come from upstairs from some room somewhere. Socks only, no shoes, a velour turtleneck, pinwheel corduroy bell bottoms. And he first thing he did is ask for a glass of wine, gets the claret, starts swirling it around, and says, all right, let's hear it then. And Mark puts it in the cassette player, and we sit down. And about the first 30 seconds goes by, and he's just looking at the floor and swirling his wine. And we think, oh, God, this is bad. Doesn't like it. And he then puts the wine on the hardwood floor. And there's an Afghan rug in front of the fireplace. He stands up and pushes it away in his stocking feet, starts dancing around on the hardwood floor and sliding, doing Mick Jagger moves, right, to the song. And he goes, I like it. I like it. And we're all like, you know, Bill and Ted's Great Adventure, you know, like, oh, we're not worthy. And, you know, we all leave all smiles and handshakes and we fly back to L.A. It's, you know, we get there on a Saturday back to L.A. and we meet with Elliot Roberts, our new manager, on Monday morning. And we're all elated to tell him the news. And he goes, look, I know what you're going to tell me. I already talked to Peter. He goes, that's great. I knew Mick would like it because I told Peter to have Mick tell you what he'd like because you guys are going to make them a lot of money because they keep all the publishing on this song. So we got the grown-up lesson.
That's true. You probably did buy Mick a boat over the last few decades.
Yeah.
Well, it worked out well for both of you. Now, you've got this new single, The Invisible Man, and yeah. I've been on the website, and I want to direct people over to GeraldVCasale.com. There's a remix of The Invisible Man, this video. This video, I don't know why I expected anything different. Again, it's just got the same quirkiness and everything, and the same kind of delightful surprises that I tend to get from your previous material. This video, tell me about the creation of this, because the visuals, the imagery around it, it just seems so surreal. Is this something you directed? Yeah.
Well, for once, I didn't direct in the way that I've directed like 70 or 80 music videos and all of Devo's videos. Since I was in it, I worked with Davey Force, who's a friend of mine, who I really respect and love his talent because he is a CGI animator. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Devo and me in particular, we're always fascinated with video and the latest innovations and technology. And he's been using AI programs. And I said, I want to do something where it's this marriage of live action and Marvel comic books where you're in this, quote, surreal world that's not really live action anymore. And it's not really a temporal space. It's an immortal Marvel comic space, you know? And he started experimenting and applying looks to live action. And the only way it would work is if we shot every element on green screen first, live action separately, then composited all the action into the environments with edits, then applied the AI program. And we worked together on it. And he came up with that. And he came up then with like, is this the look you're looking at? And I go, that's it. That's what I want. And he didn't do that originally on The Invisible Man. He did it a year or so ago on my first attempt at this, which was I'm Going to Pay You Back. So this was the follow-up to I'm Going to Pay You Back. And I wanted to make a continuity where we introduced that world and these characters and I'm Going to Pay You Back. And I wanted to keep it going. So in this one, you see the end of I'm Going to Pay You Back to recap. And it's supposedly a nightmare, what you saw, what I saw, was the nightmare. And supposedly I've woken up from the nightmare and I go outside for a walk. And that becomes the Invisible Man. And it's a Teletubbies world. I'm in the Teletubbies world.
That's right.
When I go outside. And it turns out I never woke up. Yeah, it's the like you probably had that happen where you think you've woken up in your dream is part of the dream that you've woken up.
Right.
But you didn't. You wake up after. So the next one, I will wake up for real.
Okay. So you're working on the next part of the trilogy whatever it is, quadrilogy.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. And like you said, you can only expect from me the same kind of aesthetic that is in me that I can't get rid of, right? And that you saw evidence of in the Devo videos and in many other videos I directed for other artists. Like, I don't know, I used Devo-esque tropes and techniques in Soundgarden and Silverchair and, you know, the Foo Fighters. And so of course, I'm still excited about that stuff. And I always guarantee people that whether they love it or hate it, they will not be bored. Yeah. And you confirmed that. You weren't bored by The Invisible Man.
No, not at all. I tend not to enjoy art where I can predict the next step. Or, you know, so this clearly had to, second guessing everything, which is fantastic. Now,
good.
What do you think that is? I guess the French have the word the je ne sais quoi. You know, what your view of video and aesthetics and that sort of thing. Have you thought about or do you understand what that is, what that value is?
Well, obviously, I think I do. Mm-hmm. But, you know, maybe it's clearly really something else that a critic or somebody, you know, more conceptual than myself could like say, oh, Jerry, you think you were doing this, but really you were doing this. And I would believe him. But I can only know what I know. And as any of us can only know what we know. Mm-hmm. Now it's sounding like Rumsfeld. There's certain things you can know and other things you can't know. And if you know that you can't know them, you're better off.
Oh, to me, and again, just the way I interpret it, you know, looking at things throughout your careers, there's this quirkiness that you like to lean into, which I'm oversimplifying, but it's this world where people want to be cool. People want to scrub themselves of anything foreign or strange or weird that'll make them stick out of a crowd.
And, right. Yeah, exactly. They try hard to be cool. Yeah.
And by doing that, it's an assimilation. You know, they join the ranks of everyone else. Whereas through Devo all the way through The Invisible Man, it's always been like, we're proud of our quirkiness, our uniqueness. That's a very, a very prideful kind of brave position.
I think it is brave. Like the Chinese have a saying, you know, the nail that sticks out gets pounded, and you know, because they are you know, a conformist obsessed society. But Devo said, okay, pound away, asshole. You know, that was Devo. It's like, that's right, we'll leave being cool to everyone else. Go ahead, pound away, fucker.
So what is the current state of Devo, or is there a Devo these days?
I guess Devo exists on paper. Mm-hmm. You know, Devo's on ice. I mean, Devo needs the participation and collaboration of the members to be Devo. And Marx seems to be only interested in scoring, you know, his composing. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, Devo hasn't produced anything since 2010, when we released Something for Everybody.
Yeah. But live sets, like we had Josh on the show not too long ago. He was pumped up about playing with Devo. And,
you know,
So it still exists as a live entity, occasional live entity.
Yeah. Yeah. We've made these rare appearances and proved that we could still do what we did.
There's a documentary, Are We Not Men? What's the status of that? Will we be seeing that at any point?
Yeah, you know, I'm almost like have to be zip my lips about that, because it's a source of much frustration and, you know, anxiety. Let's just say I think something will happen, but I can't attest to the veracity of that something that will happen.
Fair enough. We won't hold our breath, but hopefully by the time, hopefully we'll be able to see it at some point. So in terms of this RSD single, how many units are available?
You know how they limit you. You know, it's all about, it's all about the preciousness and the, the demand. I think it's only 2,500 units of the 12-inch vinyl with all there's six cuts, you know, A and B side, and including a fantastic lounge version of I'm Gonna Pay You Back that I did in collaboration with this Canadian artist, Jeep Jones, who's an instrumentalist and arranger and who has a real affinity for the period where great lounge music was being produced by the likes of people like Martin Denny and Escoville mm-hmm. and, you know, the Raymond Scotts of the world. He's very good. And he, you know, he respects it. He do it. You know, it's not a joke.
Right.
And so I'm hoping people like my lounge quote version of I'm Gonna Pay You Back that they can only get on this vinyl, nowhere else.
Right. I'm actually looking at your recent release. You worked with the artist Tomo 77.
Which, yeah, I love him.
Oh, absolutely gorgeous. And that is a vinyl reissue of the Jihad Jerry album.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
I guess for various reasons you decided to not revive that moniker.
Well, you know, at the time I thought everybody would understand it as political satire. I mean, here was a guy, you know, a senior citizen in a bad Sam the Sham and the Pharaoh's turban, you know, like a theatrical turban that wasn't realistic at all, and white, and titling the album Mine Is Not a Holy War, I thought they'd get the satire. And it was a response to the hideous Bush years with the ginned up invasion of Iraq, you know, and the fake, you know, finding the yellow cake or whatever they said they found, you know, right. Weapons of mass destruction. So attacking the people that didn't attack us, you know, amazing. And all I got was hate. I mean, either from the kind of, you know, all-American MAGA types who wanted to kill me because they did take it seriously enough and think I was some kind of Muslim. And then all the real Muslims who knew damn well I wasn't a Muslim, who were offended because nothing's funny to religious Muslims. I mean, humor is not exactly at the core of their religion. You know, and I'd get these, you know, I'd get a lot of hate mail, threats. And then I did an interview on Sirius XM in New York where they loved the opening track called The Time Is Now. And said, oh, man, if that was a Devo song, we'd be playing the shit out of it. And I go, well, you like the song and it can't help but sound like Devo because Devo was at least half me. I mean, I can't not be me. And they go, no, I mean, you're G.I. Jerry. We can't put that shit on the radio. We can't say G.I. Jerry and the Evildoers. Are you kidding? That's too close to the heart. And so I realized, I think Jihad's not getting the love here. And we better retire this guy.
Yeah. Yeah. You made the mistake of giving people too much credit.
Boy, did I. And how would I do that knowing what I knew after 50 years of de-evolution? I mean, I didn't listen to myself.
So, you know, looking at this timeline, the end is closer than the beginning. You've had all this experience, you know, starting early days. You've seen what happened directly at Kent State. You talked about de-evolution. Yes. At this point, are you proud of humanity or are you disappointed in humanity?
Oh, I mean, the disappointment runs so deep, you know. I have to say, though, I've actually, now that I'm, you know, a septuagenarian, I've gone beyond anger. It's just deep depression at the fatal flaw in human nature, because that's what we're really looking at here. That's the thing that doesn't seem fixable. And that's the thing that allows everything else that you're seeing, all the hate, all the bigotry, you know, all the racism, all the homophobia, all the greed, everything comes from the design of this species. So despite all the good we do and all the wonderful things we're capable of creating, in the end, it seems like the self-destructive kernel inside the human organism wins out, and you're left at best going back to square one, starting over again. But time's running out on humans for doing that, because they can only shit in their own backyard so many times before their backyard ain't there, right?
Right.
And that's what the climate—that's what the climatologists are trying to tell people: is listen, you can't keep your head in the sand any longer. It's too late. You can't keep doing this. And of course, you know what's going to happen. We're going to keep doing it.
Mm-hmm. I'm of a bit of the same opinion. What makes humans great is what makes us horrible.
Yes.
And yes. You know, to me, I think sometimes the only comforting thought is that out there's an asteroid that's headed toward Earth, and eventually we'll all be equal again.
That's right. I agree with you. That's it. I mean, you nailed it. There's nothing more to talk about on that level, because like the duality is what does us in. And even my song, The Invisible Man, you know who the Invisible Man really finally is?
It's ourselves.
It's ourselves. It's like in The Prisoner, the 60s TV show, where he finds out he's number one, right? Mm-hmm. That's when I say the Invisible Man, he's always there, he's always around, in your face and always around. Yeah. No kidding.
Yeah.
And you got to deal with it.
That's your most formidable foe.
That's it.
All right. Well, Jerry, thank you so much for coming on The Vinyl Guide. Thank you so much for talking and sharing those stories, being so open and honest, and recalling all the nerdy details that we've asked you about. It's been an absolute pleasure. I'd love to have you back to talk about other releases, any future releases you have as well. But I do want to remind folks, on Record Store Day, grab a copy of The Invisible Man. There's a 12-inch clear invisible vinyl. It's a 45 RPM, so audio-wise, it'll sound gorgeous. There's even a compact disc and a cassette version. If you see any of those, feel free to grab those as well. Also, make sure you go to GeraldVCasale.com. I'll put the link in this episode page. There is a translucent red version of the Jihad Jerry album, retitled Gerald V. Casale. Again, I'll put that link in this episode page, but it's a gorgeous record. And again, not many people got to hear for reasons that Jerry just shared. There's also a 7-inch metallic gold single for I'm Gonna Pay You Back available. Again, that's at GeraldVCasale.com. Jerry, thank you so much for coming on The Vinyl Guide. Babe.
Thanks for your time. All right. Bye-bye.
Oh man, it's such a pleasure having Gerald or Jerry now on the show. And don't forget, everyone, Jerry's single, The Invisible Man, available on Record Store Day, Black Friday. Grab a copy. Go see the video at GeraldVCasale.com. And let's follow him on social media for word of other interesting projects and events surrounding him and his musical heritage. Alrighty, that is it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. I hope everyone is well. I hope all our American friends are having a great Turkey Day week. Everyone's driving safe and being good to one another, not beating up too many people that are in front of you at the Black Friday sales. Please be safe as we go into the holiday season, and we'll be back shortly with a brand new episode. So until we talk next time, get out there and buy some music, people. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate@thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram @vinylguide. Until next time, keep spinning.